All right, so we are taking up again presence, the topics of presence and proximity for the local church. All right, thank you, sir. So just by way of review, we can think back over some of what we covered in the last couple weeks. We began by bringing up, first of all, proximity and the physical proximity that we have to other people in our church, and why is it that this is not really part of how we think about church membership generally? And when I say we, I mean this is not how American Christians tend to think about church membership generally. It's not something which is really addressed in detail in our Confession of Faith, or really at all. There's no chapter in the Confession of Faith on living close to people who are in your church. As Americans, we noted how we are particularly shaped to think about proximity by our kind of latent individualism, that we get to be who we want to be, and other people and communities that we may belong to don't really have much weight in our lives for how we make decisions, and also that we're moderns. We live in a time when we are enabled by the wonderful technology that we have to live in the way that we do, and that also affects the way that we think, right? Aldi is a little over a mile from my house. That's pretty close as the car drives. But if we didn't have cars, that would seem kind of a long distance. It would take you a little while to get there. It would certainly seem further. We also looked at proximity in the Bible. So we went through the Bible kind of from Genesis to Revelation, and we saw how when we begin to look at the Bible with this theme in mind, we see from the Garden of Eden all the way to the second coming of Christ at the end, how much this is a prominent theme, and especially the great desire is that as human beings, that we would be near to God. And that's what man lost in the very beginning. When man sinned, was he lost that closeness to God. He was in the Garden of Eden where he walked with God, and then he was thrown out. And from then on, the story of the Bible is, how can man be in the presence of God? And then the Bible ends, of course, with that wonderful statement about the new heavens and the new earth, that God's dwelling place is with man. And we can also think about, you know, how is it that God reveals himself to us in Scripture? And the key way that God reveals himself to us is in Jesus Christ. And it's in Jesus Christ that God comes near to us. As John says in John chapter 1, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And that has an impact on how we as Christians not only think of God, but it also has an impact on how we think of one another and on the way that we relate to each other. So we looked at four passages last week. We looked at Philippians 1 and 2, and we saw how in Philippians 1 and 2, Paul is teaching us that Christian affection that we have for each other should lead us to live a life of harmony with each other. I can't remember if I pointed this out, but of course, in the verses before where we picked up in chapter 1, verse 27, in the verses before that, that's where Paul is talking about whether to remain or depart, right? And so he has this desire to be with the Lord, but also he knows that to remain is beneficial for the church. We looked at James chapter 2, and we saw how faith should lead to works of love, right? And that the greetings that we extend to each other on a Sunday morning need to be lived out with works of love the rest of the week as well. We saw in Romans 15 how Paul says that the strong have, Paul says, we who are strong have an obligation to bear with those who are weak. And so we thought about that in terms of, one of the reasons why we want to be near to each other in the church is because this is what makes it easier, and in some cases what makes it possible for us to care for those who are weak in the church, is when they are nearby. And then we also looked at 1 John chapter 1, and we saw how John just begins by describing the incarnation, and that God came and John knew him. John says, what we have seen, what we have heard, what we have touched with our hands concerning the word of life, that which we have seen and heard, we make known also to you. So John is saying, we know the Lord Jesus because we were with him and because we saw him and we heard him and we even touched him with our hands. And out of that, John says, we are declaring this message to you, the message of the gospel of Jesus, so that we also, you and I, so that we may have fellowship with each other. And so John talks about how as Christians who've been shaped by the incarnation, God's revealing himself to us in Jesus Christ, we want to walk in the light. And so we saw, we took up the topic of living near each other and being involved in each other's lives from the perspective of accountability, living in the light with one another and living an open life with each other. So if I could kind of sum up all that we talked about from those passages, I would just put it this way, that God's revelation of himself, the way that God reveals himself in the gospel, leads us as Christians to pursue a shared life of love and of openness and of serving one another, and also of mission, of joint mission, and we can talk about that as well. So tonight I'm hoping to get into what I've been hoping to get into for 3 weeks, which is to get into a little bit more of the nitty-gritty. We've talked about kind of the Bible, we've talked about some biblical principles, where do we see this in Scripture? Now we want to ask, okay, so what could this look like? And what are some ways that we can take this and run with it? So I'll just reiterate briefly again that it's God's revelation of himself to us. That's what causes us, what prompts us, what convicts us as Christians to live a particular way. This is, it's God's revelation of himself that brings the church into existence in the first place. God reveals himself in Jesus Christ, and a people are called into existence, who are called from darkness into light. And this brings with it a whole way of life. There's a whole Christian way of life. We could go into a big digression and begin to talk about multiculturalism and, African Christianity and American Christianity and Asian Christianity and stuff like that. That's a whole nother topic, but I will just say this, which is, I have met Christians, obviously I've met a lot of American Christians, I've also met Christians from other countries, and it's amazing how when you meet Christians from other countries, you just kind of instantly know that you have something very important in common with them, and there are things that you can recognize right away that you share with them that you don't share even with, for example, your own family members who are not Christians. So there is something which is definitely recognizable as a Christian way of life. And if you were to turn to the book of Acts, you don't have to do it right now, but if you were to turn to the book of Acts, this helps you to see the conflict that unfolds in the book of Acts, where the Christians come into a town and they begin to preach the gospel, and the reaction of the pagans is, for example, these people are telling us to live in a way that goes against who we are as Romans. And that should tell us something about the Christian message, that the Christian message of Jesus does call people into a way of life which is contrary to the way of the world. And it's an entire, whole, encompassing way of life. Now, we can... last week, as we thought on these passages about, you know, how Christian affection should lead to a life of harmony with each other, and that faith should lead to works of love, and that the strong have an obligation to the weak, and that Christians should walk in the light. We can also think of other passages, like in Matthew 25, when Jesus describes the final judgment, and he says that that he will return, and that he will separate peoples like the way that a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And there's that powerful word that Jesus speaks to the sheep and the goats, right? At the very end, that explains his judgment, which is, however you did it to the least of these, my brothers, you have done it to me. And that is incredibly powerful for thinking about how do we treat one another in the church. There's a sense in which we want to treat each other in the church in the way that we would treat Jesus. And so when we think of one another in the church as people that we should be treating in the way that we would treat Jesus, and it is true, of course, that we would want to treat non-Christians, people who are outside of the church, with the same love, but there's a priority here. Paul says, do good to all people, especially to those who are of the household of faith. In that priority, we want to treat one another in the church as we would treat Christ. And so we can, as we think about proximity, we can ask ourselves, is it possible for us to live the Christian life as a church and ignore how near we are to other people physically as we go on through our day-to-day lives? Is it possible for us to do that? Here's one way of thinking about this, right? If Jesus lived in Oswego County, wouldn't you sell your house and want to buy a house next to where he lived? Is it possible for us to live the Christian life and ignore this? I think this is essentially the same as asking whether we can pursue the Christian life and ignore the church. Okay, if we think that in order to pursue the Christian life, you must pursue the Christian life in the church, then that immediately brings us into thinking about the church as being local. People live places, people work places, people go to school places. How can we live a life that is shared as a church? So we want to lean into the meaning of local and lean into the meaning of church when we talk about being part of a local church. Let's talk a little bit about convenience. If you have any choice at all about where you live, and some people have a lot of choice and some people don't have much choice at all, but if you have any choice at all about where you want to live, chances are you have thought a lot about convenience for your home. Convenience for what? That's the question. Convenience for what? There are many demands on our lives that we feel as demanding our attention and demanding our time, and we want to prioritize those to the extent that we have the ability to. What are some of those big demands that especially have to do with where are we physically, where are we geographically? If you work a job, unless you're one of those folks who works a job where you just zoom in, right, or you can do it online. Most people work jobs where they have to be there. And so that means you have to get yourself to work. That is a demand on your life. If you go to school or if you have children who go to school, then they have to go to school. That is a demand that is placed on you as a family. If you want your children to get into a particular school, oftentimes, especially public schools, if you want to have your kids in a public school, you have to live in the district for that school. Shopping, family relationships, those are two very different things, but they have a demand on us in terms of if you want to have groceries in the fridge, you want to live somewhere where you can go buy groceries. If you want to be near family, if your family relationships are such that you're going to prioritize being close to them so that they can come see you and you can see them without a whole lot of difficulty. I don't know, is that important for some people? There's also financial convenience. We look for homes that we can afford. We look for homes that have good property value that we can get some return on in the future. These are all different things that can be convenient that we can consider in terms of where we want to live. Well, we can also think of convenience in terms of the church, in terms of the priorities of the church and the mission of the church. You remember I read from the form of Presbyterial church government from the 1600s and the way that at that time the Scottish Presbyterians thought about how to form local congregations. And at that time what they said was that congregations should be based on where people live. There are all kinds of reasons why we don't do it that way today, one of which is denominationalism. But as they gave their explanation for this, we went through this in some detail previously, as they gave their explanation for this, they basically said, well, people who live together have more opportunities to love each other and to attend to the church ordinances with the most conveniency. That was their word, conveniency. So they're saying there's another convenience beyond commuting to work, commuting to school, shopping, and property value and things like that. There's another convenience which is very important for the church, which is the building up of the body of Christ and the relationships that we have with each other and our attendance to the word and to prayer and to the sacraments. These are also demands which are laid on us as Christians that we can think of as something that we can prioritize for convenience. So what does that look like? Well, we could just think for a second about the ordinances. So we might take up worship services, for example. What would it look like for the people of a church to say, we want to structure our lives and live in a place where attending worship is as convenient as possible? Well, I can tell you that the difference between a 20-minute drive to church and a 2-minute drive to church can be the difference between coming to church in the evenings and not coming to church in the evenings, right? 20 minutes is 40 minutes two ways. That's a long time on a Sunday evening to be in the car and if you've got kids and things like that. As well, think about prayer meetings and midweek studies and things like that. We can ask ourselves, what would it look like for a church to really prioritize convenience of the mission and purpose in life of the church? How could we pursue convenience in that? We know what it's like to pursue convenience for work. we know what it's like to pursue convenience for school and for other things. How can we pursue convenience for the life of the church? We could also ask about convenience for discipleship. This is a very simple question. You know, we, as an example, we have young people in our church. How will we disciple young people in our church if we don't spend time with them? And that begins to get into question of convenience. If it's hard to spend time with someone, then you're just going to do it less frequently. That's just a fact. If we want to prioritize being open and accountable to each other, how can I do that? How can I prioritize being open and accountable to you if none of you ever work with me, and if I never work with any of you, and if you're never in my home and I'm never in your home? How will there be accountability? How will there be openness in that relationship? How can I most conveniently serve other people in the church if it just takes me a long time to get to them? That's not convenient. It's difficult. Now, I think that we can be drawn into thinking that an act of love is more valuable if it was really difficult, right? And there's some truth to that, right? But at the same time, we need to be careful that we're not. Let me give an illustration, okay? So we can think to ourselves, well, if I'm overcoming this barrier of distance in order to spend time with someone and in order to love this person, isn't that worth more than if it's just easy to do because they're right next door to me and I can just see them whenever I want? Isn't that worth more? Well, when I was in college, I had a friend. When he was growing up, he lived in New Jersey, and his dad worked a job in West Virginia. And so he saw his dad every other weekend. And so in order to see his dad would have to drive all the way from where he worked in West Virginia back to New Jersey. And it was hours and hours and hours and tons of miles that he spent driving a couple times a month to spend a weekend with his family. Would we look at a situation like that and say that father is much more committed to his family than a father who works a job in the town where his family lives, and he comes home at the end of the day and he's with his family? You see what I'm saying? When people love others at great cost to themselves, that is a great thing. That's a wonderful thing. But we can also arrange our lives in such a way that we're actually holding people at a distance. And the reason we have to overcome these great obstacles in order to be with people is because we actually prefer to have the distance there. We prefer being able, at the end of the long weekend, to drive back to West Virginia and have 2 weeks where our family is not around. Right? That's kind of an extreme example. But that's just a way to say that it's not. It is valuable for us to want to pursue convenience and loving one another. That's a good thing. And the fact that something is convenient doesn't mean that it's cheap. Okay. So I think a question. This would be a good question for each of us to talk about, you know, as you go home and talk about this with your spouse, or you can just pray over this and think on this question. How do you weigh the competing demands for convenience? And what are those competing demands on you and on your family? Work, school, commuting, your neighborhood, your lifestyle, your family, your church. What places an obligation on you? What relationships or demands place an obligation on you that you must act on, that you must respond to? Here's another question. What is the most convenient way to pass on the Christian faith and life to the children of this church? That would be a good question for us to think about. How do we, if we were to sit down and think together as a church, what would be most convenient for instilling in the children of this church the Christian faith and the Christian life? What would we come up with? Here's another question. What is the most convenient way for this church to still be a healthy church in 100 years? And when we think about the different competing demands on our lives and the different decisions that we have to make for convenience, we should also ask another question. Who stands to benefit from the decisions that we make? Do the little ones of the kingdom stand to benefit? Do the weak brothers in the church stand to benefit? Do lonely people in the church stand to benefit? Do elderly people in the church stand to benefit? When we are evaluating the demands on our lives and we're making the decisions in response to those demands, who ultimately is going to benefit from the decisions that we make? So just to go back over those questions again, how do you weigh the competing demands on your life for convenience? What is the most convenient way to pass on the Christian faith and life to the children of this church? What would be the most convenient way for this church to be a healthy church in 100 years? And who stands to benefit from the decisions that we make about convenience? Now, I know, as we all know, that proximity can't make you love anyone. Okay? Many people who've been married for a long time could tell you that. Proximity can't make you love anyone, but proximity does make love possible in a certain way. What is that way? Well, proximity makes love possible just as distance can make love impossible. Now, when I'm talking about love, I'm not talking just about your feelings for another person. Of course, we know absence makes the heart grow fonder, right? But in order to do acts of love and service for another person, it's much harder to do that, and you have much fewer opportunities to do that if you're on opposite coasts, right? And so being near to someone gives you more opportunities to help them, right? Even down to very, very basic things, right? Sometimes my neighbor Randy and I will help each other get snow off of our driveways. It's not a real big deal. It's not a huge thing. It's not a huge thing to me. But you know, that's a way that Randy loves me. That's a way I want to love my neighbor Randy. And it's something that is convenient to do because he's right next to me. And oftentimes I'm out there shoveling and he's out there blowing snow at the same time. So love is, you know, the proximity makes love possible in a way that distance can make it impossible. You can also take kind of a military example. If you're in a unit in the military and you go into a battle, one of the last things you want to have happen to you is to get all out by yourself and be stuck on your own. That's like every soldier's worst nightmare, is being completely alone and being isolated and cut off from your unit. If you've ever watched the movie We Were Soldiers about the Battle of Yadring Valley, there's one of the companies gets separated, gets cut off, and basically for the whole battle, all they can do is they're stuck by themselves and they just have to lay as low as they can in the elephant grass and hope that nobody sees them because they can't move. And that is what can happen to us spiritually as well. We can be drawn into spiritual conflict. We can have suffering and trials. And if you don't have other Christians who are able to come alongside you and help you and comfort you and speak the word to you, you can be kind of cut off. And of course, maybe the Bible's way of portraying that to us is by describing us as sheep. Sheep belong in a flock. They belong together. And it's the one out of the hundred that gets lost and wanders away, that gets lost in the mountains, that the shepherd has to go out and find and bring it back. All right, so what are some, I've got a couple baby steps here, and maybe I shouldn't have called them baby steps because some of them are not baby steps. But what are some of these? I think the first one is just invite somebody over. Just invite somebody over to your house. You don't have to make them a meal. Just make them a cup of instant coffee. It's not, unless it's Mary Plummer, don't tell her that it's instant coffee. Just pick one person and invite that person over to your house. And then next week, invite that same person over again. And then the week after, invite that same person over again. Don't invite someone you're related to. That's good to do. Invite someone you're related to. But for this assignment, don't invite someone you're related to. Make it a regular thing. There's a story Tim Keller tells. I was reading recently and talking to my dad about Tim Keller tells the story of, he's a pastor, he's working with this couple. This couple had all kinds of problems. Nobody in the church liked them. They had so many problems that the pastor, Tim Keller, was having to spend all this time with them. And so he was spending all this time with them. And then one day he had some time off, and his wife said, "What should we do? We have this time off." And he said, let's go spend some time with this couple. And his wife was like, "What, are you crazy? It's your day off." And he realized, gee, I've spent all this time with him, and now I actually like spending time with him. And that's the funny thing, is that if you spend time with people, even people that you don't really like, eventually you find that you actually do like spending time with them. It's a strange thing. So pick one person and invite them over and make it regular. Another thing that you can do is just invite people along with you when you're going places. This is something I see y'all doing often. I see you inviting people over too. So these are kind of steps that we can all be taking together. Invite people along with you. Are you going to go to the park? Are you going to go to the library? Are you going to go to a concert or something? Just, you know, find that person in the church you think could really benefit from going there with you, and bring them along with you. You know, another way to think about this, oftentimes I think we think that in order to really build relationships, we have to like carve out all of this time and have this kind of leisure time together where we and it's nice to sit down, we have meals together and things like that, but we might think that, oh, if I really want to be invested in a person's life or get to know them, then like I need to go sit down and have a cup of coffee with them, and I don't know, we can stare deeply into each other's eyes and share all of our heart's burdens and things like that. And there's a place for that. But, you know, sometimes the best way to get to know someone is to just ask them to come help you with something. So you might, this is a great thing to do with young people, right? You have a project that you're working on, and you're getting older, and you don't like picking up heavy stuff anymore or running around, so, you know, get one of these teenagers who's always around to come along with you. Often the best discipleship doesn't happen over coffee as you're trying to, like, solve all of the world's problems. It is when you're working on stuff together, when you're folding the laundry, when you're changing the oil, when you're running errands, when you are cleaning up a big mess. I think this is actually one of the reasons why churches love doing service mission projects, because it's when you're mucking out basements in the Gulf Coast, and I guess they don't have basements in the Gulf Coast, but when you're mucking out houses in the Gulf Coast and you're getting all dirty and you're all sweaty and you've been working for 12 hours and you go back to your tent and there's no air conditioning and you're sweaty and there are mosquitoes. You know, these are experiences that are deeply and profoundly shaping on people. And there are incredible opportunities for discipleship because you have all these young kids and they're watching the adults to see, how are they going to handle this situation now, right? Well, what is that? I mean, that's stuff that happens in life. Like, you go through life and stuff happens and the kids are watching you to see what you do and you got projects that you have to work on. So, I mean, you don't have to go to Louisiana to do that. You can just go to Lowe's or your backyard. There are people in the church who might need help with things. Help, you know, talk with the deacons and see who needs help with some stuff and do that. When I was a young man, there was a man in my church named Stephen Todd who often had me come over to his house and work on stuff with him. And I learned a lot of stuff from him that I didn't even realize I was learning. You know, we would go cut up trees for firewood and we'd get all tired and worn out and then we'd come in and we'd have dinner and I'd sit there with him and his family and sometimes I'd watch him and his wife argue about something and I would learn stuff about the Christian life just by being there. And I learned a lot of things from growing up in my family and with my parents, but you know, there's some things your parents can't teach you. And that's why you need the church family. Another thing you can do, some people can do anyways, is hire people. You know, we can often think of work as being a rival to building the time that it takes to build relationships with people in our church. And so if you have the opportunity, as some of you do, to hire people, then you can kind of turn that on its head and make work for you. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean you're going to end up with the most highly qualified people for your job. It may mean that you have to spend more time with them, training them, working with them. I'm sure Mr. Jones could tell us some about that. But this is another way that you can disciple people. Think about, it's interesting, you know, people turn to Paul's letters and they go, oh man, he's talking to slaves and slave masters. And isn't that just terrible that, you know, the New Testament church had slaves and slave masters? And in some ways, yes. Now, slavery in the ancient world was, in many cases, very different from the kind of slavery that we had in this country. But there's another way that we can look at it, which is these people were stuck together. And those Christian slaves, you know, their pagan masters, they were stuck with a Christian slave. And so the way that Christian was working with them was a kind of discipleship, and vice versa. You know, those guys who had the Christian master, they were stuck with a Christian master, and that's an opportunity for discipleship. It's also just a way of helping people. It's just a way of helping people in the church. Maybe we should be a little more nepotistic than we are. When I was in seminary, actually, I basically got put through seminary by a guy in an RP church who knew I needed a job, and he hired me. And I basically worked for his small business the whole time I was there, And then I graduated, and he closed the business. And he put me all the way through seminary. He paid me a good living wage all the way through. Now, he could have, I didn't really know his field of work. It was new to me. He could have gone out and tried to find somebody else who was much more familiar with it. But he knew I needed a job, and he thought I could do a half-decent job at it, and so he hired me. And I'll tell you, we spent a lot of time working on his business stuff, but we also spent a lot of time, it just gave us opportunity to be together and to talk about spiritual things, and not just in kind of a vague, like, oh, I was reading the Bible, and what do you think this means? But again, in work, stuff happens. There are challenges that come up. There was one point when I was working with him where he had someone he was doing business with who kind of like pulled a fast one on him and really hurt him in a big way. And that was an opportunity for discipleship. It was an opportunity to really talk through and pray through together, like, how does a Christian respond in this situation? We know how the world would respond. We know how they would respond to being done like this. But how should we respond as Christians? Those are opportunities that I had because I worked with him. I don't think anybody else, even the people that he saw every Sunday at church, I don't think that they knew that these things were going on in his life. All right, another area we could talk about is school. We are all stakeholders in the Christian education of children in the church. We are all stakeholders in the Christian education of children in the church. Remember, when you think about what do we want this church to be in 100 years? Well, then that means that we're stakeholders of Christian education. So what does that mean as we think about who are going to be the future members of this church? Who are going to be the future deacons and elders and the future moms and dads in this church? Well, as we have children, I think it makes sense for us to be working together, collaborating on how we want to provide for their Christian education. Now, I think this can take a lot of different forms, okay? You could hear me say that and think that, we need to start a new private Christian school or something like that. This could take a lot of different forms, and I think it depends on where a church is and the context that it is in. It might mean we are all going to send our kids to the same public school because if we can all get our kids into the same public school, then we can have a bit more of a voice in that school as opposed to being kind of scattered throughout. It might mean trying to send kids to the same private school, although that's very expensive. It could mean a number of things. It could mean working together more intentionally and deliberately as we homeschool kids in the church. But the point is, however those decisions are made, and to some degree those are family decisions, but these decisions are decisions about schooling affect the whole church community. And so what does it look like for the whole church community to have a conversation about it? Okay. And then the final one, which is just not a baby step at all, is to move. Move near people from church. You might ask, how near? There's a writer named Anthony Esselin who says that freedom can be measured in linear feet. It is measured by how far you will let your children go from home unattended. I think that's a pretty good measure of freedom. The distance that you would let a 6-year-old girl walk by herself, that's a good measure. So how close should you move? Well, that's one way to think about it. In a church where people don't all live right on top of each other, which is pretty much every church in America, where do you begin? Because you can't just get everybody to pick a neighborhood and move there. Well, I think one way you can begin is just to think about the people in your church, and think about where could you move, where you would be closer to some of the people in your church, and where perhaps where you could be really close. Then move there. That would be a good step to take. Also think about this, and I've asked this before. Who, these are such huge decisions. Renting homes, buying homes, selling homes involves lots and lots of money. It's a huge decision. Who benefits from how we make those decisions? Who benefits from how we make those decisions? We want, in the long run, we want as Christians the benefit to be the glory of God and the prosperity and the peace of the church, with a special view towards the weak in the church, right? We who are strong have an obligation to the weak. So there you have it. That's what I've got for you this evening. Any questions as we've gone through all of this? It's week 3. Mary. Well, I was going to say, you got your marching orders now. You're not supposed to die anytime soon. All right. Art.
I just wanted to comment on the distance, proximity thing. Most people here probably know that I'm an example of my parents moving to this area because of the church. Mm-hmm. And I think that is one of the key ways that we can raise our children to know the value of the Christian community is to have them witness how serious we take it. So All of these baby steps that we do, or the big steps that we do as parents, are things that kids see and remember, and I think that's the best way to pass it on.
Yeah.
And I've also, in our church, seen over the years a good example of what you're talking about when it becomes harder to fellowship because you're a distance away. And it's almost like, even though they're part of your church and you love them, you don't automatically include them in everything because you know they're not going to be there. And it's sad. Yep. So I agree that distance thing can be a hard thing for community building in the church.
Yep.
I don't know what that distance, the right distance is, but I think certainly modern transportation makes it so that it can be a range, and still do a very good job of it. But It really still does boil down to how seriously committed are you to it.
Yep.
Because people drive 45 minutes an hour to work sometimes. I mean, people drive from here to Syracuse to work every single day.
Yep.
For them, it's no problem. And some people like it. They're good with that.
Yeah.
So, I don't know that 5 minutes or a 6-year-old walking, alone is a good gauge for how close we should live to our church, but I do think that you're right. It becomes harder the farther away you are.
Yes. Yep. Yes, and along with that, I would say that when people, including your children, see that you are willing to be further from work in order to be closer to church, that also shapes how they see, what are your priorities as a family. Yeah. Any other thoughts or comments?
Mom?
Yeah.
So I know fellowship is hard for some of those folks, and I wonder if there comes a point when you should just say, perhaps you should find another church. Even if it's not the ideal, perhaps that's what it comes to. And so when do you draw the line and get off? Get off the driving,
yes.
You know, and make yourself
more available in another body. Yes. That's a good question. And I would say we probably did see in Rhode Island some of what Art mentioned, that, you know, some of the people who lived really far away didn't always get invited to stuff that was going on just because they were far away. And I would say, too, that our experience in Rhode Island was what really began to, like, drive some of my thinking on this, because we did have people coming from so far. And not only you're coming across a state line, which is its own kind of psychological barrier, and you have distance, and you also have the traffic and just the congestion and the density of southern New England. I do think that it's not crazy for churches to really tell people, look, we're not entirely sure where the line is, but it seems like maybe you've crossed it. And I will say that this, a very, I think, extreme case of this happened in our presbytery, where some people who lived in Canada joined a church in the Southern Tier, and they were like pretty quickly told by the presbytery, like, you can't do that. You need to be a member of a church that is in at least in your own country. So in our denomination, I think it's very difficult. You know, I've talked about this with other people in the denomination, and we in this congregation are kind of a rare congregation in that I think the Standishes live the furthest away, and you guys takes you like
used to be the day hard.
and in many churches, like, they would be like the closest people. You know, or that would be like average. So we're actually in like a, I think in many ways we're in a pretty good place as a congregation. But there are, you know, a friend of mine jokes, it's not an RP church if someone's not driving over state lines to get there. And that's a problem. Like, that's a real problem. And I think part of that is that because we are a denomination that holds very strongly to a particular view of Reformed theology and a particular way of worshiping, there are people who are just unwilling to go to any church that doesn't worship in the way that we worship. And that's a really difficult position to be in, because I feel like what it does then is that you're kind of being forced. If someone's not willing to move, then they're having to choose between worshiping in a church where every week the worship is unbiblical, or being part of a church in a way that they're not really being part of the church. And you have to ask, like, so which is more important, church membership or worship? And we shouldn't like, people should not be making those kinds of decisions. And if you, if someone thinks that the way that we worship is really very important, and I do think it's important, then I would just say, if it's that important, show it. Show that it's important. Like, move there. Be part of that church. So it's a, it is a problem. It is a problem. I think that is a problem. That's specifically a problem for denominations like ours. And it's one that not many people want to talk about. But we do have to talk about it. Krista.
It also seems like you're saying that the proximity to each other is more important than the proximity to the church building.
Yeah, I mean, I think proximity, in the end, proximity to each other is more important than proximity to the church building on Sunday morning. Although there is something, there is a great benefit to a church, like A, having the church community that's close together, and B, also having the church building in that area, because that's kind of the public face of the community in a way. And that gets into how having a close community aids in church outreach and evangelism. And I think that being able to draw people into your, you know, drawing your neighbors into your community, because it's there, it's already there, you don't have to like take them somewhere to see it, is really important. But also, like, I love being able to tell people, like, I'm pastor of the church, it's just right up the road, you know. And that gives people something to see. So, but overall, yeah, the priority is going to be on the people who are members of your church, because that is the church. I mean, the church building is not the church, it's the people. John.
My thought is, and we've experienced this in the congregation, where the children are born into the congregation, they grow up, they're trained, and most of them end up moving away. And the number one way that the church built itself is by reproduction within the church. Children grow up, mm-hmm. they take the place of the parents, and, you know, the church continues on. Now, there's exceptions to that rule. But we live in a day and age now where kids grow up. They go to school, and then most of them end up away from him. Some of them do that. It seems to me that it's important, I think, in rearing children to keep that in mind and to try to direct them and guide them in a way where they can find their niche. And it's not always easy, mm-hmm. but I think it's missing. You know, we live in an age where, you know, we're led to believe we can do anything we want to do. We go any place we want to go and be anything that we want to be. And that's just not biblical.
Yeah.
You know, certainly parents, one of the primary things they do is to examine, to study their children as they're growing up to find out what their gifts are. But they have to be taught. This, you know, you excel in this. This is what you should be doing, you know? And it's just a thought, because we seem like, and I don't think we're alone in this. I think other communities in other states, other churches in our denomination suffer from the same thing, where the progeny escapes them. And, I mean, we're constantly building. We have people coming in, but... trades are suffering tremendously today.
Yeah.
Where those folks would be making a better wage than someone who's gone to school for 6 years. Yeah. And they're constantly looking for people. And yet, now I'm not saying I know that within our own congregation, many of our children are being directed in that area. And I think that's a good thing because we really need them, and it's a good living. And they can probably find it around here. And they're looking for people.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, so one of the reasons why I like having these discussions is because they're, you know, I'm trying to give you some of the principles that I see in Scripture, but in terms of how to actually kind of work out the application in our own church, I've kind of given you some of the starting points and some of the what I think are very basic applications to our own setting. But I expect that as you all think on these things, you will think of other ways to apply this in our own church that I'm never going to think of. Last week, Chris mentioned that we should think differently about our fellowship meals in light of these things. And what are our fellowship meals for? I was not going to think of that. And I'm really glad Chris thought of it. So do think on these things and do think on, you know, the principles that we've looked over, and what do you think are some ways that we can be applying this or working this out in this church? So there you have it. All right. Well, thank you for coming and participating and for all your comments, and we'll see you next week.